Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I chat to George Eaton and Stephen Bush about Labour conference and what we hope to see in Jeremy Corbyn's speech. Then we chat a little bit about Labour's class of 2015. After that, John Elledge, Barbara Speed and I discuss whether or not it's time to start caring about the US election in 2016. Labour MPs are about to decamp to Brighton for their annual conference. The Lib Dem conference in Bournemouth, I think it's fair to say, was not a headline grabber. But I'm joined by George Eaton and Stephen Bush to discuss Labour. First of all, I'm going to kick off with you, George, because you had an interview with Jeremy Corbyn, all hail, this week, in which he talked a bit about a kind of differing approach he's taking on differing policy questions. So on things like Trident, for example, he said he's, you know, happy to leave it to, you know, the will of activists and how they vote at conference. On the benefit cap, however, he's decided that his word is law. Do you expect that conference is going to be a more decision-making body than it has been previously this year?
Absolutely. So throughout his campaign, Jeremy Corbyn talked about how he wanted to democratise the Labour Party's policy-making structures so that motions passed at conference would actually mean something again. And in the past, previous Labour leaders have disregarded them. And that means some sort of big flashpoints. The first will be Trident on the Monday. If the motion is approved, which is likely to be for debate, then activists will have the chance to vote on that. It's very hard to say how that vote will go because some of the unions are opposed to Trident. Some of the conference delegates who were decided before the outcome of the Labour contest may not necessarily take a Corbyn line on this.
Maria Eagle, who's the now Shadow Defence, she's pro Trident, isn't she? So this is, I mean, partly is this a kind of way of Corbyn of saying, well, I'm actually more in touch with the membership than MPs are. This is my way of reaffirming that this is my mandate, even if MPs disagree with me.
Absolutely. I mean, for Jeremy Corbyn, nuclear disarmament is one of his big causes, and it's not one he would want to compromise on. But a lot of MPs expect him to ultimately offer a free vote on the issue to them in the Commons. So you could have a very odd situation where the MPs have one position, the conference has a different position, and then it's Labour has a policy in its manifesto, which the majority of its MPs, or certainly a significant part of the Shadow Cabinet, don't support.
And Stephen, what are you most looking forward to about Labour Party conference? Apart from the New Statesman Party, which will be banging.
Apart from the New Statesman Party, so a distant second to the... I am actually intrigued as to how it will work, because there are lots of advantages to letting members set policy at conference. One of the reasons why Lib Dem conference is... Yes, it wasn't very newsworthy, but it's a more vibrant and kind of more engaging affair.
And also, I think because of all the singing that they do. They seem to do like a lot of glee club and karaoke and stuff.
But one of the things they do is, one thing they didn't very clever, which Labour did not do when it used to let conference make policy, is because making policy is quite a fractious occasion. The rest of the Lib Dem conference is effectively designed around the fact that you have a fight in every conference session, but then at lunchtime it's like, go and hear Nick Clegg speak. There's a Doctor Who screening. Let's all go to a fringe on electoral reform. These are all sort of issues pretty much every Lib Dem can unify around the fact they like STV and Doctor Who. The Labour Party has never been very good at finding ways and it can disagree without it becoming water the knife. And the other problem is once you give policy to conference, the main way you make a splash in the conference speech, if you're the leader, is to announce a policy. Jeremy Corbyn can't really do that now. So the main thing I'm looking forward to is whether or not he can give a good speech, given the limitations he's placed on himself. The fact he's only been leader for 2 weeks. Apparently there isn't even a draft of it yet. This is like, you know, politics with the difficulty level turned up to 11. So,
George, what do you want to hear in Jeremy Corbyn's speech? We've had lots of discussions about how difficult his first week was, what a hostile media climate he's facing, the fact that his first speech at that special conference was a speech to his supporters rather than a prime minister in waiting kind of type speech. What does he have to do?
Well, I think what he has to do is speak to the country, which I think even some supporters would acknowledge he struggled to do in his acceptance speech. He has to offer sort of vision for the country beyond opposition to the Tories, beyond opposition to austerity. So how does he want to restructure the economy? What is his vision for public services? What is his agenda for devolution? He set up a constitutional convention to look at the makeup of the UK's different bodies, and how does he envisage that playing out? And then he does need, as Stephen said, a bit of a rabbit. He does need something which is going to make some headlines the next day. A distinctive policy. And I think he was right to go with rail renationalisation early on, because that is a policy of his which has support across the electorate and which even some Conservative voters support. Obviously, it would make sense for him to talk about the NHS. That's another issue on which his instincts are close to those of the public. But in terms of Labour winning an election, his biggest challenge is obviously economic trust. And That is a huge challenge, but it's not one that can be ducked. So, in some ways, this is his first conference. Given how divided the party has been, given how little time he's had to prepare for it, he could play it safe, but that's not going to win you an election.
And Stephen, I did have this weekend an email in from a listener who says that for her, she finds us all slightly too Corbyn skeptic, and I wondered from your point of view as somebody who's probably not a natural Corbyn supporter, what do you think his strength is? If you were advising him to build on his strengths, what would you identify those as?
He has a couple of strengths, which is borne out in the very early polling. And he's basically Miliband on steroids. People think that he has a strong idea of what it is he wants to do, that he's very sincere, that he's in touch with the concerns of ordinary people, and that he's, and crucially, has a fourth, I mean, I've lost count now. But another advantage Ed didn't have, which is they think he's authentic. He has that Nigel Farage quality that people think he is who he says he is. So he can build out from those things. The problem, not to call out our listeners or anything, the problem is it's very easy to talk about what people's strengths are, but you have to identify your weaknesses and try to get rid of them. You know, the Conservatives, for example, were hugely aware that they had a problem that Cameron is Poshy McPoshington. And that's why he does all those things going, oh, I love Frozen, I love a box set, oh, the kids keep singing Let It Go. All of that is just about gently taking the edges off his biggest weakness. I don't necessarily think that Jeremy Corbyn can't deal with his weaknesses, but he won't deal with his weaknesses by his supporters sending angry Twitter messages or him saying in interviews, don't worry, I'll target non-voters.
Well, let's quickly, before we move on to the next bit, talk about this non-voters thing, because we had some polling in from Peter Kellner of YouGov that looked exactly at, you know, who are Jeremy Corbyn's potential supporters, who are his current supporters, and how do they differ from kind of Labour supporters. And I thought there were several really striking things in there. You know, the number of Corbyn supporters who describe themselves as very or fairly left-wing is 81%. Firm current Labour voters, that's only 40%. Potential Labour voters, only 15% of them describe themselves as very or fairly left-wing. There were some other things, you know, that this is one of the things you pointed out is that 4% of Corbyn supporters think that George Osborne would make a better prime minister than Jeremy Corbyn, which is a truly baffling. Although I kind of attribute that, there's a great bit in the Sex, Lies and Ballots, I think, where they asked people to how confident they were in a minister that they'd made up. And 15% said that he was doing a very good job, but they really liked it. Because people are notoriously reluctant to admit that they might not have all the information at hand. But only 67% of Corbyn supporters, I thought this was the most interesting, said they want the government to do far more to help the poor and tax everyone else more to pay for this help, which I thought was... And people were very... Actually, I had some responses on Twitter of people who were upset and said that that was a leading question. And I said, well, to me, that's what the point of a progressive taxation system is you say, if you've got a little bit more, you can afford to help a little bit more. And people under, you know, between now 10 going up to 12 £1,000 don't pay any income tax. So they won't be through income tax paying to help other people. And I was quite surprised. I mean, George, when you saw those findings, what was your initial reaction to them?
Well, my initial reaction was, Jeremy, the voters, most voters are in a different place to Jeremy Corbyn supporters. And Jeremy Corbyn supporters think in very ideological terms. Most voters don't. Most voters judge a party based on its leader, based on whether they trusted on the economy, based on whether they trusted on public services, and then the overall image of the party. So those things matter a lot more than policy in some ways. But the tax one is interesting because I think it's a bit of a post-crash phenomenon where it's become almost politically unacceptable, even for anyone on the centre-left, to advocate higher taxes on anyone apart from the top 1%. Mm. So I think this idea that, well, people's wages did fall and still haven't fully recovered in some cases. But it's interesting, and Jeremy Corbyn himself wrote a piece on pensions for the Daily Telegraph before his election, in which he said, you know, the basic rate of tax used to be 25%, it's now only 20%. We need to have a discussion about this, which was notable in that politicians so rarely go there now. I mean, Labour, when it was in office, raised national insurance to pay for the NHS. And there was a debate before the last election about whether Labour should try and pull that off again, to have a clear, sustainable source of funding for the health service, and also to reassure people that it could make the sums add up. But it was decided that's no-go territory because of the squeezed middle, because of the tax bombshell. But it's a good question. Just how are we going to fund public services in the future if it's only politically acceptable to raise taxes on the top 1%.
And Stephen, to pick up that point about non-voters, there is this idea that non-voters are a reservoir of diehard lefties, and if they can merely be sort of tapped into. But that's not what the evidence suggests, unfortunately, is it?
No. In the British Electoral Survey, when people were asked to place parties on a left-right scale and themselves on a left-right scale, non-voters placed Labour to the left of where they were. There are some demographics which favour Labour which do not turn out, young people who live in cities, ethnic minorities. There are strong arguments for why you should try and increase turnout from all of those groups for kind of civic engagement reasons. However, for example, in where I live, if ethnic minorities turned out at the same rate as non-ethnic minorities, Diane Abbott would have an even bigger majority. But Labour doesn't need Diane Abbott to have a bigger majority to win the next election. The flip side is, you also turn out the other side's voters who don't bother to vote. Obama is kind of the classic example of this. He had huge turnout spikes, which allowed him to win, I'm going to confuse my Carolinas, either North or South Carolina. Turnout went up by 8 points. Turnout in Arkansas went up by 15 points, and he lost that by a bigger margin than John Kerry had the election before, and Clinton had won that state because basically people who were inspired by voting for the first African-American president were motivated by fear of a black president in other parts of the United States. And in America, it's easier to benefit from non-voters because they live in different places. In marginal seats in Britain, basically you have a fairly accurate soil sample of what Britain looks like in most of them. So if you increase your turnout, you're increasing turnout among your opponent's voters as well. You've got to convince, if you do a good job convincing the other side's voters, a lot of the time you'll get some non-voters as well, and that's great for reasons which have nothing to do with winning an election, but are just good for society, at least in my opinion. However, if your response to that poll is to go, don't worry, we'll target non-voters, your response to that poll is to say, basically, don't worry, we will definitely lose the 2020 election.
Well, on that slightly apocalyptic note, I just want to move on to talk about a feature that we've all contributed to, which is the idea of a class of 2015. What does Labour's 2015 intake look like? George, you interviewed Stephen Kinnock, as the surname suggests, the son of Neil. He's got a very interesting background, and where do you think he sees himself in the spectrum of the party?
So I asked him, of course, because his father was obviously they identified with the soft left of the party, and he said, I reject those labels. you know, I believe that you know, we should cut income tax actually and shift the burden of taxation towards assets. You know, but he also has he's a modernizer in terms of attitudes towards public service reform. So he doesn't want to put himself in one box, which, given how divided Labour is at the moment, is quite smart. But he did describe himself as a radical and said, "I'm a radical in the true sense of the word," which is etymologically it means someone who looks at the roots, someone who goes to the roots of an issue rather than just the symptoms. And he's obviously someone who is always going to attract attention because of his surname. But I am impressed by him as a speaker, as a thinker. I think he will be someone to watch.
And Stephen, you spoke to Wes Streeting, who is one of the sort of rare success stories of somebody who was put in a very difficult target seat, Ilford North, ended up with a small three-figure majority in, you know, when much easier to win seats didn't go Labour. He would have been in the old days, I guess, a Blairite, but I know we're now, by pain of death now, not allowed to use that word. But, you know, is he somebody who sees there being a point, you know, who does he work with in the party? Where, you know, is his career kind of over before it's already begun because his faction is not in the ascendancy?
Wes is genuinely quite collegiate. He is good at working with people across divides. He does have the slight problem. It's an incredibly marginal seat. You would assume that with boundary changes, it will perversely get a bit safer because it will gain some Labour voters. So, I mean, a bigger problem for him is, can he hold his seat if the numbers for Corbyn don't improve and the action taken to improve Corbyn's standing is not taken? That's probably more of a problem for him. But he does sort of have this slight problem. He's kind of an outrider to a movement which doesn't have any
in-riders.
Yeah. But ultimately, you know, there aren't very many MPs and there aren't even very many Labour MPs who went from being on free school meals, raised by a single mum, all the way to Cambridge and becoming an MP. And so I suspect there will be some kind of role for him. And he hasn't been one of the kind of, you know, obviously he didn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but he hasn't been one of the people who's been trashing Jeremy and attacking his voters. So it may be that he's able to survive and come again.
One of the things I thought was interesting, I mean, we obviously made our own kind of subjective selection, was that we ended up with a few people, so Kat Smith, Clive Lewis, Kate Osamore, who were big Jeremy Corbyn fans. And George, my impression is that, you know, Corbyn has quite a following in the 2015 intake.
Yes, actually, had the 2015 intake not been so left-wing, I don't think he could have made it onto the ballot. That was always the problem in the past for people who tried before, like John McDonnell, who's now, of course, Shadow Chancellor. And the new intake will have an important role to play if things do get as tough for him as some predict, because he does need people who will go out and defend him in the media. And Kat Smith and Clive Lewis were quite prominent during his campaign and are both now shadow ministers. And so although the divisions in the parliamentary party so haven't quite erupted yet, that people do try to be friendly and civil towards one another. I mean, that...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Could start to change if it looks as if Jeremy Corbyn's in real trouble.
Well, talking of people being civil and cordial, I mean, one of my interviewees was Jess Phillips, who famously had a ding-dong with Diane Abbott in the first PLP meeting. She's certainly very outspoken. I would recommend her as an interesting person to follow on Twitter. But actually, I think the person who most surprised me, for non-political reasons, was talking to Thangam Debonair, who's the new MP in Bristol West. because she discovered a lump in her breast within 2 weeks of being elected as an MP. She said she hadn't been taking care of her health on the campaign trail, and then has gone straight into, she was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer and has gone straight into chemotherapy, which basically 1 week in three, she can't really do anything. But what was interesting about that was that how much stuff she can do as an MP without needing to be in Westminster. And that was something I hadn't really ever thought about. So she can't submit oral questions, but she can do written questions. She can't represent herself in debates, but obviously she can get through constituency casework. And obviously she can still write blogs, she can still tweet, she can still kind of go to things that are in her local area. But I thought that was quite a touching story, really, actually, because I think it's something that people kind of forget, that MPs have very normal everyday struggles in their life too. And for me, the other really interesting theme that came out is how many of the people that we interviewed, and they weren't all London and South East by any means, how many of them brought up housing as a really big issue. I mean, Keir Starmer, who's the new MP for Holborn and St Pancras, said that every other person in his constituency surgery has got some kind of a housing problem. Sometimes those are related to immigration, sometimes they're purely about, you know, not being able to afford social housing, having been kicked out of private rents or whatever. But it does seem that that's something that Jeremy Corbyn has done quite well, actually. He's identified a shadow ministerial team about housing, but it's something that the 2015 intake, who are quite young, who are quite diverse, probably, I would imagine, we were having this conversation earlier, some of them might still be in the private rented sector. I mean, this is something we talked about when we talked about Mari Black and some of the younger SNP MPs. For the first time ever, instead of, you know, a bias towards landlords, you now have actually more people coming into the Commons who have an experience of being a renter. Were there any other trends that either of you identified in the 2015 intake?
It's a very interesting intake. I mean, it's true that it's to the left of past intakes, but you do have more modernising, more moderate MPs in there, such as Wes Streeting, such as Conor McGinn, who used to be an advisor to the Shadow Northern Ireland Secretary, Vernon Coker. And so it's not quite true to suggest that all of the new MPs are on the hard left of the party.
I thought the interesting thing, to me at least, was only something I realised once we'd done all of them, is actually it is a... there aren't very many SPADs in there, but it is actually a very Red Prince-y intake. Kate Osamore is the daughter of Martha Osamore, who was a sort of huge and influential figure on the party's left. Ruth Smith's mother was an Assistant General Secretary of a trade union. Stephen Kinnock, obviously, is Stephen Kinnock.
Yes, I suspect that given Keir Starmer was named after Keir Hardie, his family were quite political.
Quite Labour-y, yeah. Which, I mean, to be honest, I personally don't have a particular problem with it. I don't think the 2 years I spent working in a shop made me a better journalist. I think being a journalist has made me a better journalist. But, you know, I don't think there's a problem with professional politicians. But I did find it interesting, purely because it speaks to a big problem for the left, not in terms of how it gets people in as MPs, although that's a problem too, which is, and it's very easy to give people... more money or more advantages, and there are lots of people who are not from kind of gilded backgrounds, but it is much harder to work out how we redistribute soft capital, and there's a lot of soft political capital within that new intake, and it's how you get genuine outsiders into Parliament. It's very easy for the Tories, because the outsiders they want tend to be people who are at the end of their careers, who have a lot of money and success behind them, like Anna Soubry, very impressive politician, but it's much easier for someone in their 50s to give it all up and become an MP. It's quite hard to find your next party leader that way.
Yes, that was something that came up when I spoke to people for my motherhood piece, actually, was that there were several people behind the scenes in the Tory party who said they really wanted to target 50-something women who'd had a really good career in business, had, you know, built up, weren't actually now not too worried about the money, their kids were gone to university, and those people they thought would make really good MPs. But again, that comes back a bit to the problem that you have of MP salaries being what most people would consider an excellent salary, but not compared to, you know, a GP or a, you know, even heaven forfend, a banker. Is that it's quite attractive to people who've already made their money elsewhere, but it's not as attractive to an incredibly bright graduate who could do all kinds of other things as well, particularly with the kind of hatred now of people who kind of parachuted in SPADs. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing far more from lots of the class of 2015, but for the moment, thank you, Stephen and George. Well, next year there is a US presidential election, but the big problem for Brits is, should you care yet? John Ellidge, our City Metric editor, has argued that you should. Barbara Speed, I'm going to say you probably don't care yet. I medium care in that I follow a few people on Twitter, but that's been really the extent of it yet. John, first of all, outline where, when, I mean, the big kind of starting gun really is the primaries at the beginning of next year, isn't it? Until then, can we just opt out?
I mean, the difficulty is that the US presidential election has gone on for so long that the race has already been going on since what seems like the late 19th century. But nothing really happens until February 1st when you get the Iowa caucus, which is followed just over a week later by the New Hampshire primary. Those are the first sort of actual electoral battles at which the 40 or 50 people currently competing to be the Republican nominee for President of the United States in 2016, the voters actually get to sort of tell us their preferences among them.
I think the Republican field is really fascinating because obviously the way it's been shaped up is that everyone has sort of expected that Hillary will be the Democratic nominee since about 2009 or something like that. Mm. I mean, certainly throughout Obama's second term. She's obviously now being challenged by Bernie Sanders from the left. But you watch these debates that they have, and it's just like a wall of white men, and then Ben Carson, who's the only black candidate, and Carly Fiorina, who's the only woman candidate. And you just think, I feel kind of sad for all the other candidates who are obviously the one that's not Trump, no, that guy, though. How distinctive are they, John?
Not very is the problem. I mean, there is a reason that everybody is focusing so much on everybody's favourite slightly crazy property tycoon Donald Trump, which is by far the most interesting. You probably wouldn't want him anywhere near the red button, but he is the one who's coming out with the most interesting sentences, and a lot of the others are a little bit interchangeable.
Well, let's stop and let's give Barbara, as our kind of designated normal human in this situation, how many of the Republican nominees could you name at this point?
Probably two.
There are 15, two others have dropped out.
But I think that also, I mean, they probably, what's so amazing about America really is that they have these unbelievably long campaigns and yet people still care. Like, I think that in the short campaign here, I think people in Britain struggle to care for the entire length of it. So actually, to hand it to the candidates, if any of them have stuck out so far, they deserve a round of applause.
Think about how we all started to go a little bit mad with the Labour leadership campaign going on for 4 months, and the US presidentials go on for, you know, 2 years, effectively.
Exactly. It's
Imagine
amazing.
Stephen Bush after a two-year Labour leadership campaign.
Imagine the American Stephen Bush. That's already a great prospect. The thing I think is really fascinating as well is that you don't have a dynamic like you had last time. So last time it was Obama going for a second term. Everyone thought he's pretty confident it would take, you know, somebody's is going to have to basically put up somebody to kind of get beaten by him. So they had this whole primary season where it felt all the way through it, everybody was going like, yeah, right, you've had your, you know, get all the nutters on. Come on, let's see what they got to say. And then we all know that we're going to pick Mitt Romney at the end of it. That doesn't seem to have happened quite the same way for Jeb Bush, who's being lined up as that kind of, once everybody's kind of had their primary fun and we've heard from all the people who want anyone who has an abortion to be, you know, shot and for gun licenses to be issued to, you know, fetuses at birth, then we're kind of, everyone will turn around and go for Jeb Bush because he's the establishment candidate. But that hasn't worked for Jeb, exclamation mark, has it?
I think the problem for Jeb Bush is he's very much the Yvette Cooper of this race.
In that sure, he's Jeb we can, isn't he?
But he's the establishment candidate. He's probably one of the more sensible ones on the bill. There is a sort of family connection there. And I think everyone was, as you say, expecting that at some point the field would sort of line up behind him. What's actually happening is that there is a general, it feels quite global actually, sense of frustration and outrage with the failure of political systems. And people want to try something different. And say what you like about Donald Trump, he's definitely different.
That is a diplomatic way of putting it. I do feel a bit sorry. I confess to feeling sorry for Jeb Bush. Although I feel bad because calling him Jeb Bush, because doesn't Jeb stands for, I mean, the B in Jeb is for Bush, right?
I think he's very much like Job from Arrested Development, isn't he?
So anyway, I'm just going to call him Jeb. But, you know, he is a much better candidate than George W. Bush. I feel like if I was him, I would be consumed by bitterness. Like, both in kind of in interesting demographic terms. So, you know, he speaks Spanish, he's got a Hispanic wife, he's been a governor of a big state, by all accounts, did that pretty well. You know, he's kind of a decent, you know, if you're going to have to pick a Bush brother, really, to be president, you would pick him, I feel. And yet he seems quite chipper about the whole thing.
Well, I think maybe nobody can quite believe they will push come to shove pick Trump. You think that Jeremy Corbyn's success was an upset. Donald Trump getting the Republican nomination would be the orders of magnitude greater than that, I think.
There's a fascinating piece in The New Yorker a couple of weeks ago by Evan Osnos, who was originally following white nationalists around and then ended up kind of veering off and covering the Trump campaign. And some of the stuff that people say is really fascinating about him. So they make this criticism that they think all of politics is, you know, politicians are all in the pockets of the money men. And therefore, him being a billionaire means that he's less in hoc to kind of... He's much better able to represent the kind of the common man.
Yeah, you cut out the middleman.
Yeah,
the
exactly. So he's at least the only... Yes, okay, so he's incredibly rich and has no idea how we live, but he made his own money and he's not... You know, that's not anyone else's money. We at least know that it's him, which is...
Yeah, and there's also this whole... I mean, obviously, I highly doubt Donald Trump has spent very much time listening to Jeremy Corbyn's speeches, but there is a funny way in which when they both of them talk about politics in a fairly abstract way, you can't really tell them apart sometimes, that they say the same phrases, they say kind of...
I was struck by that in this profile, that there is that populism is obviously a really potent force, and it can be just as potent to one for right-wing politicians as left-wing politicians, because you do hear a lot of, you know, there's an establishment, it's all sewn up, you know, I'm an outsider... I'm going to speak honestly. But then almost every, you know, actually Obama's campaign, I mean, the whole idea of every, you know, every campaign now is run on a kind of I'm an outsider, kind of I'm going to bring about change, I'm going to smash the system. John McCain was, you know, a lot of his campaign rested on the fact that he was supposedly a kind of outsider and a maverick and, you know, that kind of thing, despite the fact he'd been a senator for donkey's years. If you had to put money on it, John, would you say that you think that Trump will end up being the Republican nominee?
I don't actually feel like I can answer that question.
Okay, what about will Hillary Clinton be the Democratic nominee?
I think she probably will, but she's facing a stronger challenge than anyone had expected. As you say, Bernie Sanders I think he's one of the few politicians in the US who would actually describe himself as a socialist, is running quite a successful insurgency. There have been isolated polls, just a couple, but they have come out showing him ahead of Clinton in the Democratic field.
She also has this bizarre thing of her emails hanging over her head when they keep saying that maybe they've managed to recover some of the ones that were deleted. And I think that her record as Secretary of State, I mean, this is another kind of interesting facet of politics, is that if you have held a really big job in politics before, it's almost now in some ways a hurdle, because you will have made enemies, you will have made really big judgment calls that people can... I mean, I will cheerfully confess that I don't really understand the ins and outs of the conspiracy theories around Benghazi and what happened there, but that is a big motive. And, you know, you repeat those kind of things enough, people begin to think there was something there.
And she is hated. I mean, the Republicans absolutely hate the Clintons in that sort of, you know, irrational firming at the mouth kind of way. I also think it's worth bearing in mind that you will very rarely lose money betting on misogyny. One of the things something I noticed recently when Sanders was kind of gaining on her was Tim Montgomery, the British right-wing commentator, was tweeting, right, this is getting silly now, it's time for Joe Biden, the current vice president, to get into the race. And it read very much as if he was saying, right, you've had your fun, but now it's time for the serious candidate to get involved.
I think that's really fascinating because, you know, we had Nikki Wolf on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he and I both have a sort of sneaking tender affection for Joe Biden, because Joe Biden just seems like he's having quite a lot of fun. But he's got exactly the same problems that you've got with Clinton. You know, you can associate him with everything that people don't like about things that the Obama administration have done. Clinton is phenomenally controlled in what she says, whereas Joe Biden is got a touch of the Prince Philip's about him, which, you know, you can either find charming or you can find a liability. He's not... a kind of silver bullet to arrive that will solve all the problems if you don't think that Hillary Clinton's got what it takes.
He's also, I mean, by the time the next president takes the oath of office, Joe Biden will be 74 years old.
And people mention Clinton's age anyway, which would seem that it's even more misogynistic if you're then saying, well, let's have this older guy in instead.
Yeah, we think this woman's too old. Yeah. Bring on the older guy.
Yeah.
But... I mean, the odd thing about Biden is I don't think anyone, until quite recently, even considered the possibility he might run. It's just, you know, it's quite normal for the sitting vice president to be the presumptive nominee when the president stands down. That wasn't really expected with Biden, or in fact Dick Cheney before him.
That's what I was going to say, is that Biden has always been, the model has always been that he was a Cheney-style vice president whose attraction really was that he wasn't sort of sitting there scheming for the top job all the time. He was quite happy to be kind of a complementary force to Obama. So it would be interesting to see him pivot on that and turn around. I'm going to draw this to a close, but I'm just going to say that as soon as you said New Hampshire, I thought, I'm going to rewatch The West Wing. And that made me think, I'm sad because this is one of the greatest problems of British politics, is that it is now ruled by a generation of people. Well, certainly this was always the problem in Ed Miliband era Labour, a group of people who had grown up watching The West Wing and basically wondered why everything couldn't be like The West Wing, and they couldn't have, you know, let Bartlett be Bartlett, insert, let Corbyn be Corbyn, let Miliband be Miliband, let Ed Balls be Ed Balls. So
you start using real politicians' names, you kind of see why it doesn't work, don't you?
Let Angela Eagle be Angela Eagle, goddammit. And on that note, thank you very much, John and Barbara. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.